Computer Science E259, XML with J2EE. This is Lecture 5, XPath 1 and XSL T1. My name is David Malin, and last week we introduced precisely these topics. Those few of you who were here last week, what were some of the takeaways? What do you recall from our discussions last week? XPath? Okay. It's good, very good. Someone want to call out the other? All right, well, how about this? What was XPath? Okay, so it's a query language. It allows you to extract data from an XML document using these hierarchical queries. XPath query was called on the aggregate by a what? That was one of the smaller components. Yeah, path, or more precisely, a location path is what constitutes an XPath query. Inside of a location path are one or more what? One or more nodes, but it's not so much nodes because that's what you get out with the path. Steps. Okay, so we talked about taking each of these steps, and in turn, each step was broken down into two components. And I think we heard it a moment ago. An axis, which tells you what kinds of nodes you want to consider it at this particular step. Whoops. I hate people like me. Okay, so in each step, you might follow a certain axis, which tells you what types of nodes that you want to consider. What else was a step made up of? A predicate could certainly be applied, and a predicate was a means of filtration so that you get back a group of nodes, and you want to either keep nodes in or, in effect, keep nodes out. But a predicate was prefixed with what? I heard a few things. A node test. So a node test in its simplest form was often just the name of the node that you wanted to get, whether it was movie or title. But it could be a function, a node test. What was one of the functions that we saw used as a node test last time? Starts with is an XPath function that we don't see as a node test. We see in the confines of a predicate. And we'll come back to that today. Match was an attribute of XSLT's various templates. So elements, but really we saw a function like, node, which pretty much told us grab any type of node on the given axis. We also saw specific names. We also saw star, which was a placeholder for a node of any name, but it was a node of the principal node type, but we'll get back to that today. And we'll see a few more such node tests today. But hopefully, after last week's lecture and over the course of the past week, you've been able, if you've had time, to tinker with XPath queries. And if we handed you an arbitrary XML document, say myblockbuster.xml, and we said, give me all the titles from this document, that hopefully, even after just last week, should strike you as fairly easy. And if it doesn't yet, I think it's useful to go back and review the basics from last week, because tonight what we'll do is delve a bit deeper into the syntax and to the feature set of both of these particular languages. We looked last time as well briefly at CSS, but for the most part, CSS as it relates to this class will be up to you to use if you want to use it for aesthetic purposes, but you could certainly get away in any of the XHTML output we do without using something like that. But we did talk about it as a style sheet language. We spent most of our time, though, on XPath, XSLT, and then in effect, toward the end, tracks. And tracks is something that will recur in projects 3 and 4, and that's where we'll place our emphasis on it. But we did briefly define tracks last week. Tracks stands for... Okay, so transformation API for XML. And generally speaking, you know, what acronyms stand for is not so important, but in this case, it sort of tells you what it is. Just as JAXP is the Java API for XML processing, so is TRAX the transformation API for XML processing. So for the most part, in Project 1 and the lectures thereabouts, we focused on the parsing of content and the retrieval of content and the programmatic access to an XML document through SACS and DOM using generally JAXP. Well, moving toward Projects 3 and 4 in a few weeks, as well as in these next several lectures, we'll begin to touch upon a subset of JAXP known as TRAX, which essentially is all the portions of JAXP that focus on transformations. And that generally means XSLT-related stuff. And we talked briefly about Project 2. What we'll do in tonight's section is, again, have similar sort of Q&A, but now that you've hopefully all had time to read over the project specification and think on it to some extent, I'll do more of a walkthrough of the code as well as of the problem so that you know what you should be equipped to do after last week and this week, and what you might not be until next week's time. Questions, administratively or otherwise? No? All right. So last time we focused on XPath, first and foremost. We talked about location paths. We also talked about data types ever so briefly, pretty much waving our hands at it, because we said that XPath, like XSLT, pretty much borrows data types from what that we've seen before? DOM. And so much of data typing in XPath and XSLT is really transparent to the developer, so it sort of suffices to have familiarity with the node types that we saw in DOM and sort of just assume that those same nodes exist in the context of XPath and XSLT. And we'll see as the semester progresses, there's a lot of sharing of previous specifications and concepts and so forth. Just to rattle off some of those data types, though, we've seen in DOM, and we've now experienced with XPath and XSLT, what kinds of data types in this world? I'm sorry? So we've seen strings as a data type, sure. We've seen number last week with XPath and XSLT. So text or string, seen Booleans and so forth. And what about the types of nodes in an XPath or XSLT context? So element nodes and nodes, text nodes, comment nodes, and so forth. So pretty much we've seen syntax, or we'll see syntax, for all those kinds of concepts as well. And we've also seen some functions, not many. I pretty much whipped through a lot of those slides because it's not that much fun to spend more than 5 seconds on the function called starts with or count and so forth. Most of this is not only self-explanatory, but even if it's not, you know, any of our online references, particularly the one we keep preaching, W3 Schools, really has a nice lists, if not usage examples, for those sorts of things. But you did see, hopefully last week, a good list, if not totally exhaustive, of what kinds of things you can do in XPath. And what you'll begin to appreciate as you really sink your teeth into Project 2 is that it doesn't do everything. And that's why you'll soon see XPath 2 and XSLT 2 nearing completion, and you'll see that those eventually will redress some of the shortcomings you'll hopefully experience or notice for yourselves don't actually exist. But what we will touch upon tonight is what are called extension functions, and we'll see how the world, or specifically XSLT processors, have enabled developers to cope with certain lackings of functionality. XSLT2 nodes, elements, templates, we'll focus more on those in just a bit. And so for now, we focus on tonight XSLT continued. So data types that we looked at as it relates to XSLT last type were these first three that we rattled off. And then there was this notion of a node set. So you hear node set. What do you think of now? What does that mean? Put that in some context. Yeah. Perfect. You execute some XPath query, and you get back a bunch of nodes, which in effect are a node set. And so far, as we've seen, you pretty much only interface with a node set by way of iteration, or we'll also see random access with a few functions tonight. So that's what a node set is. It's zero or more nodes that are returned. External objects is a feature that allows you to do some sort of not built-in type things, and result tree fragments, we'll see an example of tonight, is this weird sort of data type that actually can cause you undue angst, but there are ways currently around it, and XSLT2 will redress that feature or lack thereof altogether. But we'll come back to that. We will. We will. In fact, we'll have an example tonight that distinguishes precisely those two. Indeed. Okay, so what I thought we'd do tonight with not only presenting some of these basic constructs, but try to focus as best we can on actual application of them. So what you see up here, for instance, is the canonical structure for an if condition, but that in and of itself is not so interesting. So why don't we try to play with some of these things in context using arbitrarily stylus, but several of you have talked on the listserv about other options for playing with XPath and XSLT. XMLSpy on Windows is another popular choice. I like stylus for lecture purposes because you can make the font nice and big and it's relatively straightforward to use. So with that said, let's go ahead and whip up a little, let's say, XSLT document. So this is a blank XSLT document. I will arbitrarily associate it with myblockbuster.xml, if only because you're probably well familiar already with what's in there, and so we'll tinker with that. So if we want to play around with, for instance, this very simple construct of if, describe for me a small challenge with which we can write some XSLT that makes use of this construct as it relates to myblockbuster.xml. What do you want to do? So if the rating of a movie is R, what do you want to do? You want to see just the R-rated movies. All right. So we'll start here. Stylus churned out this default template or this default style sheet. It usually suffices when getting started with this to use precisely an editor like this that jumpstarts the process, copy-paste the examples we've given you thus far. But none of what's up there is all that scary for now. We've waved our hands at these namespace issues, but we'll finally highlight those next week. But for now, we'll start with just this template that matches slash. What are these three lines here poised to do? What's this all about? If you could be, if it films well. So those three lines that I just highlighted, these three lines. It represents a set of nodes. Not quite, I would say. Okay, so this is clearly going to match on the parent, or really the root of the document, the true root, not just the root element. Okay, and what do we mean by a template here? It's a template that matches the root. What does that mean? Specifically to the root of the document, will this template be applied? And we described it quite simply last week as a sort of method that gets applied, for now, automagically to the root of the document. Because when you associate an XSLT document with an XML document, it's the XSLT document that in effect gets applied to the XML document. Well, what inevitably is going to be the very first thing that could possibly be matched in an XML document? Well, according to our rules of parsing, it's going to be the root. And so the simplest way to sort of jumpstart the process, certainly at this point in our experience with XSLT, is just to say, all right, match the root, and let's dive on in from there. Well, what do we want to do? If we want to now get all of the R-rated movies and display these in a resulting, you know, web page or text document, what do you propose we do? Based on last week's constructs alone. Okay, so we could quite simply open up before each construct, iterate over the nodes in question, and then churn them out. So let's see. Let's go ahead and do XSL for each. All right, stylus is going to answer a lot of the questions I could be asking tonight, but select is what we want next. What do we want to select? So we could just type database. It would be equivalent to write this. But it's, in this context, unnecessary because what axis are we already implicitly along? Well, root's not an axis. Child. So, right, child, there are only so many axes. Child and sibling and preceding sibling and so forth. Well, what's implied here is that. Why is it appropriate to just say database or child colon colon database? Well, of what is database a child? The root of the document. So that makes sense here. There's no inherent inefficiency here. So let's go ahead and iterate over the database. Now we can go further in our document. What came next? Okay, so we can say movies. Movie. Okay, you want to stop there. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and close that construct, go inside of it now. What do we do now? If the goal, again, is to print the titles of all of our R-rated movies. Okay, we go with our if, XSL if, recalling that the structure is quite simply that. Okay, if. Yes. Well, it's not sufficient to just say equal to. Okay, R. Close quotes. What do you want to do? Value of. All right, good. Value of select, and then we can say title. What here is the implied axis where the cursor is blinking right before title? It's the axis. Axis. So it's still child, right? It's always child, and that's okay here because what is the context node? It's a movie element. In fact, on this iteration, it is a movie element, the ith movie element. And here, too, rating was what, an attribute or a child of movie? In our document from Project 2, it's a child, so there, too, is it appropriate to do this. And then just to really beat the issue, why do we not consistently write child, colon, colon? It is the default. It's assumed, it's sort of a waste of time, but sometimes useful, especially when you start writing style sheets that do employ a number of different axes. Sometimes it is, in fact, helpful to be so explicit, if only for the readability, but not as it's not requisite for the functionality. All right, so now I'm going to go ahead and save this as, let's call it 1.xsl. And now in Stylus, you hit play. In Xalen, you would type a command line. In XMLSpy, you would click a little button as well. Depends on the program. Here we have it. This is our little preview window down below. It's a little messy because Stylus, at least, is showing you the web IE view. It's an embedded instance of IE. If we just go to the pure text view, what we have is this. Not so pretty, but we could very quickly whip up a little web page if we wanted to format these things as HTML. What do we do to achieve this? Quick and dirty HTML page. Where do we put what? I'm sorry? Okay, so we probably want some br tags in there, and because we're outputting, well, we'll output XHTML, so we'll keep it well-formed. All right, close, but that's not a valid HTML document. Even now, IE will, see, IE kind of chokes on it. So what do we need to add still? All right, so in the root element, or in the template that's matching the root, we can write a raw HTML element down below here, maintaining symmetry. We need that. Up here, if we want to be valid, we actually need head, and then we need title, and then we can just call this one, close those, and now we need a body. And then down here, we can go ahead and close the body. And ignoring the doc type stuff that we've very carefully copied and pasted into your templates for Project 2 and so forth, so this isn't quite valid XSLT2 because we haven't associated a doc type yet, it's at least a good approximation. Let's go ahead and pretty print everything, run the output, and now we actually have a web page. Okay, still not fundamentally that interesting, but at least now we have the fundamental structure with which we can build up more interesting constructs. First thing we might want to do, for instance, is sort these things. We have the R-rated movies, we want to sort them. How do we achieve this, based on last week? Okay. Or XSL?
Yeah. Colon
sort.
And select.
What do you want to sort on? Okay, and we want to sort specifically on the title. You'll notice, and again, here too, any of these WYSIWYG editors are actually useful learning tools because you don't need to turn to a manual when you're being explicitly told what the options are. And again, it's, I think, more of a learning tool than it is even a cheat sheet because it does reinforce it. Well, you can specify an order attribute, saying ascending or descending, which would get you one way or the other. Language is not so relevant here. Data type, if you wanted to be explicit as to the data type, 9 times out of 10, that's not necessary. Case order as well, lowercase and uppercase, how it deals with the intermingling of the two and so forth. But for our purposes, we can get away with just saying sort on title, reprocess the document, and it's a little small still, but it is now, in fact, sorted. All right, so suppose that I wanted to print something differently if it weren't rated R, but instead were rated PG-13. So do we proceed to do... Okay, right, this was that ridiculous construct last week. You don't use if is an atomic construct. There is no if, else construct in XSLT. There's an equivalent, but the jargon is not so pretty. Rather, you have this canonical structure. You have a choose construct. For whatever reason, this was the route they took. And what you effectively have is an if condition up top, followed by zero or more effective else if constructs, but they themselves are still called when test. Then you ultimately have an otherwise construct, which is equivalent in effect to the default or the else condition. So if we wanted to do something slightly more interesting here and actually say, well, let's print, like we did I think last week, the R movies in red and the G movies in green, well, we can do something instead like XSL choose, which does not take any attributes, ignoring this one for now, which is an XML thing. I'm going to clean this up in a moment. So now we have an XSL when we have a test, when the test is such that the rating equals, just to be clear and hammer another point home, this would be wrong for my first parser reasons. Should be clear why that would probably break your own parser and should. When test rating equals R, we're going to go ahead and output the XSL value of the current value of the title. But we're going to do it, say, in XSL, font color equals red. Just output some raw HTML. Below that, we'll close the font tag. Let's get rid of this test down here now. There is no else construct. So now if we want to deal with the green movies, we'll copy paste this, paste it on in to save some time. Go up here, change the rating to G, the color to green, still print out the title. And now hopefully you're realizing there's probably other ways you could write this with slightly less redundancy, because already now I have two instances of XSL value of. That's really a programmatic thing and not really fundamental to XSLT here. And then if it's not, you know what, either R or G, well, let's go ahead and say XSL otherwise. Let's go ahead and output the thing as just black text or whatever the current color is. So we'll output that just as raw text. We've forgotten one thing. We still want to include our BR tag. I say we when it's really me. Oops, no element allowed after XSL otherwise. What's the problem here? What have we done? Good. So it's not valid to have another element in there because only certain children are allowed per that element's BTD or the XML schema that defines XSLT. But we can put it there, running it now, viewing it in a preview mode, and now we get a sorted, color-coded display of all of our movie titles. And you can certainly imagine doing even slightly more interesting things with these very simple constructs. Okay, questions on conditions, John?
You did the match on the rubric. Could you have done a match on /movie/movie?
Let's go back up to here. So you're proposing what kind of match up here?
Could you have done /database/movie/movie?
Okay. Movie/movie. Ah, interesting. So let's actually do this so that I can preserve the results of what we play with tonight. Let me go back to the original. I'm going to save this. Let's go ahead and create a new instance, which we'll call 2.xsl, and I'll put these online later if you would like. So this is now 2.xsl. We change the title accordingly. So John's proposing changing the matching template itself to actually match on the node that's actually in question. Let's go ahead and simplify this whole procedure now and get rid of most of what we wrote, and think about what we want to actually output here. So if we've now defined a template that very precisely doesn't just match the root, but very specifically matches a movie element that's a child of a movies element that's a child of a database element that's a child of the root of the document, to be as precise and verbose as possible, what do we want to proceed when we have matched one such node to do? Okay, so XSL, value of, select title, which is still a child of the current node. Oops. I'm going to save it. I'll do a BR again, keep things slightly pretty. And if I process this, what are we going to see? I'm going to see titles. I'm hearing some murmurs, some head shakes. We see kind of a mess, which is a great segue to actually what these templates are really all about. So we're seeing a mess. Just instinctively, or just by recollection, when have we seen such messes outputted before? When we print the value of an element, because we said by definition the value of an element is what? Right, the concatenation of all of its textual descendants. So what this almost suggests, if we're getting messiness like all of the actors' names and then we're getting all of the titles, but now they're not even sorted, we scroll down a little further and nothing really seems to have happened as expected. Right? We removed the sorting, so we do see the titles, but we also see all of the actors. So what's going on? Why are we seeing the actors? What's inducing that behavior?
The default template for all of their
elements. Excellent. So I'm going to fast forward a couple slides. Iteration we already took care of as we did sorting. Recall this slide. And we did this toward the end of class because we'd be coming back to it tonight. But these, we said, were built-in templates for XSLT, which means if you have a blank XSLT document, or almost blank, you still have a style sheet element, and you have a well-formed and valid style sheet, but you don't have any templates defined in it, the ones you get for free are these. Now, going in reverse order, what is this implying that the default behavior is for processing instructions when encountered in an XML document? What does the XSLT by default do with a PI? No, it's doing something similar as it would to comments, and ignore for now mode, because we'll come back to that, because that wasn't in last week's version of this, but it was implied. So this element here, this template here, is what handles the default processing of processing instructions. What does it imply should be done with a PI?
It looks like display anything I don't understand.
A reasonable inference, but not quite the case, because what's this? Ignoring it is effectively what it's doing. What this empty element, this is an empty element, it's got a bunch of attributes, and a few of you wondered a few lectures ago, what is the point of an empty element? Well, here we start to see, when you have multiple attributes, now in an interesting context, they can absolutely be useful, because what this template, this method is in effect doing is saying, anytime you match a node that's either of type comment, that is when the node test passes the comment test, or the node test passes the processing instruction test, that is, the current node is a PI, well, do nothing. If you wanted, for whatever arbitrary reason, to change that behavior and actually say, hello world, what this would instead do is literally output to your resulting document, hello world, for each and every comment and PI that was encountered in the document. Rather nonsensical, but hopefully makes more clear the fact that when you don't have such text within as a child of your template, well, it does nothing. Well, now let's work our way back up. This middle one here, excuse me, matches what kinds of nodes? Tech nodes or attributes. So the vertical bars are union operators, so in effect it's saying text nodes or. And what's this crazy syntax with at star? What does that specifically mean? Anytime you have the attribute axis and then an attribute star, any named attribute is what we're saying there. Well, what do you want to do anytime you encounter a text node or an attribute? You want to go ahead and print out the value of that text node or the value of that attribute. And that makes intuitive sense, right? When you want to print the value of a text node, what do you want to print? Well, the value of the text node. When you want to print an attribute, what do you want to print? Well, you don't want to print the attribute's name. You probably want to print its value, hence value of. John?
What's the meaning of mode?
Ignore mode for a moment. Pretend it's not there. We'll come back to that.
So going back to the bottom one, which was comment or processing instruction,
mm-hmm. Because what a template does is it says, when you match this type of node, do the following. But insofar as this is an empty element, there is no following. It's like writing in Java, a function avoid method foo that does nothing. Not quite the same because there's a notion of matching here, but the effect is that. So working our way finally to the top here, what does the first template match on? Any element node, in effect, or the roots of the whole document. And that is the template that is jump-starting this whole recursive descent processing of an XML document when it's fed to an XSLT style sheet. Well, why is that? Well, if you don't define any templates yourself, the very first node, first of all, that's going to be encountered when you apply a style sheet to an XML document, we said is what? The root of the document, right? Per our parsing lessons. What is the very first thing you encounter when you start to read an XML document? Well, by definition, the root of the document. What this template then says is if you match the root of the document, which by nature you will, what do you want to do? Well, you want to, quote unquote, apply templates. For now, assume that that simply means from the root, proceed recursively to apply whatever templates are appropriate to, specifically, those nodes. When you don't specify a select attribute to this XSLT element called apply templates, what is implied is child colon colon star. So what is this really saying? This says when you match the root of your document, proceed to apply whatever templates you have to the children of the root of the document. We'll now contextualize this with myblockbuster.xml. The root of the document has what children? A database child. So in effect, what this built-in template is saying is when you match the root of the document, proceed to apply any templates you have that exist for the database element. Well, if we don't implement any style sheets ourselves, but instead have just an empty style sheet document, like this one, for instance, well, where are we in our recursive descent processing? Well, what you just said was, at this point in our story, we've just applied whatever we've said apply whatever templates exist for the children of the root. You said the only child of the root is the database element. So which of these default built-in templates, given that I haven't implemented any myself, is going to match the database element? The top one. Why? The star, right? The star denotes any element or an element by any name, so the default behavior that XSLT ascribes to the database element is going to be, all right, apply whatever templates exist for the children of the database element. Think about myblockbuster.xml. What children does the database element have? Okay, actor in order, actors followed by a movies element, and that's it. So in effect, what this is saying now is, all right, we've now matched on both the actors element, and in a moment we'll match on the movies element, but for now we've matched on the actors element. What template matches that node? The top one, right? The story quickly becomes recursively uninteresting because from here we now match with the same template because star matches movies as well. Well, actors. Actors has what kind of children? Actor. What template matches an actor element in the absence of any from our own style sheet? The top one. All right, so for each actor element, we apply whatever templates we've got. Well, that template is, again, the top one, as you just said. All right, so what children does an actor element have? Only a text node, which is Ford, Harrison, for instance. Right, and just bear this in mind. Recall what our document looks like. If we go ahead and open up from Project 2, myblockbuster.xml, recall that the only child of an actor element was the actual actor's name, him or herself. So at this point in our story, again, to be clear, what we've just said is for each of the actor elements, apply whatever templates you've got to their children. Well, what kind of children do they have? Text node children, so which template applies to each of these children? The second one, and the default behavior for a text node is to print the value. Now, if you can make this mental recursive leap on your own in the absence of any templates, and John, this will come full circle to your original proposal, in the absence of any templates specify, if I click process now, what's going to happen? You're going to get the concatenation of all of the textual children of, in effect, the root of the document. And this is where we see a whole big mess. Everything in the document gets dumped out, and we'll look at it in text format. Notice what, in effect, you get is the whole document with all of the XML tags stripped away, because all you're printing out is values of, value of, value of, value of. And so that's why the default behavior, in effect, is to print a whole big mess. So now, John, let's come back to what you proposed earlier and see why it might now make sense. So what John queried was, suppose that we match not on the root and then do this iterative thing, but instead match precisely the node we want. Well, what we've just done, and just to be clear, who's doing what? Let's go ahead and do this. Let's just arbitrarily put two parentheses on either side of our title, just so that we can see who's generating a title, whether the built-in templates are our own. Let's process this and look at the output. We'll notice now in the output, we currently have all of these titles with these parentheses, but up top, we also have all of the actor elements values. So who can explain why this is the case? Yeah?
Any specified template is going to take precedence over the default.
Any specified template, exactly, that you provide, you would hope is going to override the built-in. Otherwise, you could never implement anything. So clearly, we've overridden the default behavior for a movie element.
But what you're doing is you're applying that match to every element that's in this set of data, and when it doesn't match there, it goes to the default, which is pretty good.
Almost. But even though this is the only template we've defined, and even though in previous stories it's been our own template that jumpstarts the story, which in fact, when we apply this style sheet to myblockbuster.xml, is the very first template to get applied now. The built-in template, exactly. We have not provided a template that matches the root. We have provided a template that matched, and I said it this way intentionally earlier, a node called movie that's a child of movies, that's a child of database, that's a child of the root of the document. What this does not mean is that start at their root and proceed to get only these nodes. What this is really saying is when in your story you encounter a movie element to which apply templates has been applied, and that movie element happens to be a child of a movies element, which is a child of a database element, which is a child of the root, don't use the built-in template up top. Use this one that I have been so particular to define for that type of node. So in other words, and this might be even easier for our distance students, if you literally rewind to where we were 10 minutes ago when I was telling that very boring story about what happens every time you call apply templates on the children, the story is exactly the same until the point when I asked you, all right, well, what kind of nodes does a movies element have as children? What was your answer? Movie elements, and I said, okay, movie elements are having apply templates applied to them. Which template will be applied? And you said previously the top one. Now we have overridden that behavior. You now should have a different answer, which is this template, which in spirit is much more specific than the top one is. And that's essentially the rule that XSLT uses. The more precise you are in your matching pattern, the higher the priority that template will have. So clearly this full path is more particular than just star, which would implicitly have a lower priority.
In the second template, mm-hmm. Say if you come across an element that has an attribute and also a text node, would the processor process
Ah, would it process? Okay, so if you encounter an element that has both a text child and an attribute, just as an actor element does, which of those gets processed first? Well, let's consider what our example is in this case. Okay, so what? Recall the output that we had a moment ago. Were we seeing the attributes at all? So the default behavior is actually not to print the attributes. Let's go back. In fact, we can do this very easily. Just let's delete our template, reapply it to the style sheet, make this a little bigger so that we can see. And we know, let's just focus on the actor elements because we know each of those has ID attributes, but are you seeing them by default? No. And the reason for that is, let's look at this default template. The default template says when you match an element, which template am I talking about then? The top one. To whom do you apply templates? Only to the children. If we wanted to print out the attributes, this is not the built-in behavior, but if we wanted to, we could say select not child colon colon star, we could say attribute colon colon star. Or we could actually say or attribute colon colon star, or just to be more succinct, at star. But that is not the built-in templates definition. And so that's why when we preview this output in stylus, select equals child colon colon star, that's why when we preview this result in stylus, we don't see any of the attributes anyway. They're thrown away. Value of where? Oh, sure. Sure, we could list the attributes in some way. But in perhaps, or arguably, a reasonable reason that it's not included by default is if you're effectively just printing out the text, children, and you're essentially stripping away all the XML tags, and I would have to read the specification to know what the motivation truly was, but it doesn't sort of, it's not obvious how you would print them or where you would want them printed. And so I think it's reasonable for them to remain omitted altogether because what you have here is, in fact, the document, but with just the metadata entirely removed. And it tends to be attributes that are metadata and not actual data, but that's by design. So, John, we haven't forgotten about you. We'll come back to finish your story, but different question?
Mm-hmm. So if it matches on the first built-in, then it ignores the rest of them? Why wouldn't it have printed out the attributes? Why didn't it match on the first built-in and then match on the second built-in?
Because there is no order implied by the mere fact that our template says match star or slash. The order derives from our parsing process. So recall, when you apply an XSLT style sheet to an XML document, the first node encountered, we said, during our parsing tail is the root of the document. So it doesn't matter that I've written star before slash. It's slash that in reality is actually encountered first during the parsing of the document. So it is that node that we match on first, the root of the document.
Mm-hmm.
It's done, well, let me put it this way. The only reason XSLT, in effect, is recursive, the only reason that you have, in effect, this recursive descent processing is because of which line on the slide?
Select child.
Really, that whole line, line 2, right here, apply templates. In fact, watch this. If we instead go back to our dummy style sheet here, and again, it's empty. So if I hit process, we get the whole document out. Why is that? Because of that drawn-out story before that's recursive because of the built-in templates. But if I instead say XSL template match on the root, and you know what? Nah, do nothing. Will I get the entire contents of the file now? Well, no, because I have now overridden the built-in template that matches first, and so when I now process the document, well, I apply the style sheet to the XML document. The first node matched, by definition of parsing an XML document, is the root of the document. Well, what template matches the root? Looks like I have two possibilities. I have this one that I wrote, and I also have the freebie that comes built in. Which one have we said has higher priority? the one that we actually define and that's not built in. So ours gets called. Well, what does ours say to do? Niente, nothing. So it doesn't do anything. The process stops. Only if I included myself in a apply templates call would that recursion resume. And so let's finish off the question from John that originally sparked this line of conversation, which was, if we have a template like this, we still have this ugly result of getting all of the actor names, but also the titles in these parentheses. So the latter part is fine. That's what we expected. How do we get rid of the actor elements? I'm sorry? So after database, so we could do this. But then now we're going back to example one, which is fine because it worked. But think about what's happening here. What this template in effect is doing is overriding the default behavior for a, what kind of element?
Movie
element. That is a child of dot, dot, dot. So we need to override the default behavior for the other nodes that are problematic. Well, we might as well override that functionality as high in the tree as we can so that we short circuit as much recursion as possible. Right? I could say, let's override the default behavior of the actor element. But what's going to happen then? Well, in effect, the built-in templates are going to be applied to actors, and then we're going to be calling, in effect, recursively, apply templates on every one of the 12 or more actor elements, which we could just say should have the behavior of doing nothing. But that, too, is sort of wasteful. Let's take it one step higher in our tree. Where can we short-circuit the default behavior for all of that actor branch? Why not do that? So in effect, if you again now rewind 20 minutes in our tape and listen to the story of what was happening during our recursive descent processing, one of my questions at the time was, well, what are the children of the database element? And you said two. You said an actor's element and a movie's element. And I said, okay, what template matches the actor's element? And you said the first built-in template. But now your answer should change. What should now be applied? This template, which I've explicitly defined, and I could be even more explicit, but it's just not necessary because I know the structure of my data. I could say that, but not necessary because, again, I know the structure of my data. But we could. If I now apply the style sheet, look what goes away. What if maybe I'm not quite following, and so I think, well, wait a minute, if I implement a template, maybe I actually have to say apply templates, and then I'm going to select all of my children, reprocess the dot, whoa. Well, that's precisely the behavior that I didn't want to happen. Well, I could have said this. I could have said, all right, apply all of this to my children that are called actor elements. Well, what's going to happen now? Same thing. What if I'm being kind of stupid and I say actor elements should have templates applied to them? Okay. Correct output, not really correct implementation. But the reason should hopefully be clear. What that line of code is now saying is apply templates to all of my children that are called actor with an ER. There are no such nodes, so in effect, nothing more happens. But that's a typo, not a good design decision. But hopefully the reason why it fixes the problem nonetheless is more clear now. And this is why, incidentally, that in lecture 4, I personally find it much easier to start our exploration of XSLT by just saying, this in effect is our main routine, and let's pull the data out as we want it with that iterative approach. What we've just been doing for the past few minutes is what one might dub a push approach, where in effect the whole XML document, if you think of it, the process, is getting pushed through the style sheet, and the style sheet, meanwhile, is matching each of the nodes as they come in. So in example one, recall we had the for each approach, we matched on the root, and then I kind of pulled from the document only the nodes I wanted. I said for each of the database children that's called movie, give me that node set and print out the title. So I pulled the title out of those nodes. The way we did this more so in example two now was again more of a push approach, which is really just a different mental model whereby rather than thinking of the style sheet being applied to the XML document and pulling out what you want. It's sort of like the XML document is being pushed through the style sheet, and the style sheet is simply applying whatever templates are appropriate as those nodes come in. And what's the first node to come in to the style sheet? The root of the document, which is where our tale began. Question?
Yeah. Say you have a very large XML document, lots of action movies, so on.
Mm-hmm.
And you really want to just get to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having to do the MG template for each one of those subnodes, you just put the root, and then if something comes afterwards, it will automatically supersede that.
If anything comes after. So the question is, you have a big XML document and you only want to deal with a subset of it, like the title elements, and you effectively want to get rid of or ignore everything else. So your proposal, rather than taking this approach where we override the behavior in effect of all of the other nodes, or at least the highest ancestor possible for those nodes, you're proposing that we instead match on the roots. And so... So match on the root, do nothing, but now you want to, for instance, say XSL and have another template match on just the title element?
No. Put back what you have.
Okay.
It's got a choice is the issue, right?
Now, if we don't do anything to the root template,
okay.
It's applied.
Okay.
Right? So can we put, remember before, if we didn't have anything, we put just a root thing, and said do nothing, we had an empty document.
Okay.
Right? Like in code, if you do something in code where you come across something, and then the next thing that happens, this will supersede what happens up there. So can we do nothing for the...
What's the pressure we can
root, and then do something for the title? My question is, if you have 50 movies, notes, like movies, mm-hmm. and something else, the way you wrote it, you have 50 of those closed templates, basically do nothing to those sub. If you want to use back on movies.
If we just want to act on a movie element,
right.
So, and get pushed back on me if I'm not answering the right question.
Can you not change it? Because that's,
okay.
To me, that's interesting. It's fighting over, there's two different things that are going to try to react to things of type movie, for example.
Mm-mm. Think back to why I've been describing the second template in reverse order verbally. Correct. This one does not imply match the root, from there match database, from there match movies, from there match movie. What this in pseudocode is matching is saying match movie elements, and then it's implicitly saying only if this movie element is a child of a movies element that is a child of a database element that's a child of the root of the document. So the match is on the final step in the location path, if you will, not from left to right. It's an effect from right to left. So that is why you don't have two templates contending for each other when we write it as this, because that path is only checked once you get to the movie element. It then checks, wait a minute, is this along the right path? That's in effect what's happening. So if you have, that's a good question. So if you have a myblockbuster.xml that is so big and so much more complicated that it's not sufficient just to short-circuit the actor's element's behavior, but maybe there is also a genre's element and a movie studio's element, and so for everything else you might think of, well, let's think about how the process must begin. The reason that this does us a disservice is because the built-in template is kicking in first. Well, clearly we seem to want to override that. So we can, the default template, hopefully I won't lose my voice by the end of this, the default template by default tells us to do what here normally? To all the children of this node. Well, why don't we try to fix things here? XSL apply templates to what? Okay, well, we can't just say movies, because, again, it's context-sensitive. Database, well, okay, lazy man's approach. And that can get you in trouble, because you can end up matching things redundantly. So let's be as precise and as efficient as possible. What if we do that? Play. Didn't look that interesting. Nothing happened, but that's because it too is correct. And what this is doing is a nice solution to the problem you proposed, where maybe my blockbuster can't be as easy, you can't ignore as much content as you might like with just a null implementation of a template matching actors. So let's just override the default template that jumpstarts the whole process and say, you know what, don't start implicitly recursively matching every node. Rather, just hone in on the nodes you care about. And that would work too. So really now we've seen three different solutions to the... Four different solutions on it. Sure.
What if you just overrode what you did for text and just did nothing?
If we overrode the default behavior of the text node, we've got a slight problem. We have a slight problem. So you're saying do that? So if we do this, this too works. And why does this particular clip work as is? Well, what's happening in our story? And I didn't mean to say problem there. We have why does this particular example work? Well, what is actually controlling the printing now of... Sorry? What's actually controlling the printing of this value?
The value of selected prints now in the text doesn't control.
It's the logic that's the way it's written.
It's the logic that the way it's...
I don't think it's that. What it's doing is it's going through the whole tree, and when it gets to the text elements, it just doesn't print them anymore.
Correct.
But when it happens to find this piece of code, it's doing what it always does.
So why does this line of code that I've highlighted not, in effect, result in no output? Because what is this doing? It's printing out the value of title. Well, title has what kind of children? A text node. Well, what's the default behavior when you apply templates to a text node? Okay. But we haven't called apply templates. We have called value of. Had we instead said up there, apply templates to the children of the title node, which in effect normally would print out the textual children, well, we haven't done that here. And in which case, with that new template up top, that's bad, because now we've gotten rid of that altogether. But using value of is functionally distinct from saying apply templates. Question? So yes, way number four.
No, way number three, would that be faster?
Way number three. Yes, absolutely. So So that's, I retract my retraction earlier. There is a problem with it, which is precisely what we tried to avoid, I think, with example two, which was short-circuiting the parsing of the document, or really the processing of the nodes. This one is going to let you get all the way to the leaves of your parse tree, and only once you get to the leaf node, which is a text node, is it going to say, oh, don't do anything. So example four, as we've now proposed, I would say would be inferior to, say, three, two, and one because of its unnecessary processing. But it does achieve the desired effect. Number three would be the fastest. Number three and number one might be arguably equivalent or within a close approximation, because number one was in effect the same thing. We matched on the root and then we dove on in and we said get only these nodes. In effect, that's what we're doing here, except that that time we pulled the nodes into a node set. We iterated over them in this last example. Rather, we grabbed the node set, and then we pushed them to whatever templates were meant to be applied. So number one, depends on the implementation of your processor, might actually be more efficient because of the unnecessary function calls, if you will. Yeah? Can we do what? In the match?
The movie.
Okay.
If you are interested in a particular element like the title, can you do the title?
So could we match on just the title elements and then print out the values here? So we could do something like that. Whoops. Oh, thank you. So we could do something like that and get back the same approach as well, too. That would work as well. So I think I, more than anyone, need a 5-minute break. So let's take our break now. Help yourself to some cookies. All right, so I think we'll go tonight until the tape or my voice runs out, whichever comes first. So I think it's more fun as we continue to look at actual code than talk about sort of boring PowerPoint slides. So let me just feed you a couple of more constructs, and then we'll look at these in the context of some of tonight's printed examples that you have a handout of as well. I said a little while ago, ignore the issue of mode for then. Well, for now, appreciate that these templates that you can define also can have what are called modes, so that you can have multiple templates defined that match the same nodes that both match foo, for instance, or both match movie, for instance, but have different mode attributes. The reason for this is that you can then, when you say apply templates, specify, in effect, what subset of your templates you want to be applied. Because you could have two templates that match a title node, one of which happens to print out a title in all caps, one of which happens to print the title just as is. Well, you might have a mode associated with the former called mode equals quote-unquote all caps. When then coding up your style sheet, you are ready to print titles, you might say at some point, apply templates, select equals quote unquote title. And what that's going to do is going to apply all the templates to nodes called title. But you might further say, wait, apply templates, select equals quote unquote title, mode equals quote unquote all caps. So that you're further telling the processor, yeah, apply whatever templates you've got for the title element, but only use that one whose mode is quote-unquote all caps. So it's a way of having different templates match the same nodes, but you can call them on demand, in effect, or you can have them applied on demand. So for instance, in this top line, these are the built-in templates, and the built-in mode for the built-in templates, you get the built-in templates that you see here for every mode that you might define. Tuck that away, it probably won't be relevant, but if you're wondering why you're getting certain default behavior, just know that if you start to use modes, which for the most part you don't need to for any of what we task you with, just realize that you get for free a built-in template for any mode that you might possibly use. And by use, I mean anytime you say mode equals quote-unquote something, you also get not only that template, but all of the other built-in templates for that mode. But again, just tuck that away in case you're noting some anomalous behavior, because I don't think it's worth getting caught up on for now. Another use for something like modes might be if you want to have for debugging purposes. You might want to have some templates that are designed effectively to be debugging templates that are more verbose, that they don't just print the output that we want for a project, but they print out a whole bunch of other information that's useful to you while you develop. Well, it's a lot easier if you can simply change one line of code in your style sheet, for instance, one up top that just says, okay, go ahead and if you've got a template called match on the root, well, you might like, for debugging purposes, to say, well, yeah, apply templates and match on, or rather, select database slash movies slash movie, but you know what? Let's do this in mode debug so that I print not only the stuff we talked about printing earlier, but some other information for some definition of other information. And this way, when you're ready to submit, now you just go like that, and now it operates as it should per the spec. So it's just a way of defining multiple templates that match the same stuff, but they can be called or applied on demand by specifying a mode when you actually apply templates. Okay. With that said, another tidbit to be aware of is that you can actually hard code the priority of a template. We've been saying so far tonight that it's the degree of specificity that implies the priority of a template, right? The built they're so general, you know, star, what is that, like text, it's so general, so vague, that those have in effect the lowest priority. Anytime you implement a template that's more precise with its match attribute, well, you are giving it implicitly a higher priority. Well, you can actually quantify these priorities. When you have a node test in your mat, or rather when you have a match value that is something like foo, which is the name of an element, or bar, which might be the name of an element, well, the implicit priority that that kind of template gets is what's called 0.0. It's just the baseline. So that means if you go ahead in your style sheet and you implement XSL template match title nodes, you've just overridden the default behavior of the title node when apply template is called on it, and that template has a default priority, an implied priority of 0.0. Now, why does yours get called instead of the built-in one? Well, the built-in one, by definition, has a priority that's lower than any of these values. Moreover, if you are so precise as to specify, okay, so this here should do some stuff. Well, suppose you want to have another template. Suppose you have a document that has title in two different locations. One might be the title of a movie. The other title might be a title of an actor, like Sir Anthony Hopkins and so forth. You might have a title that's conceptually different, but the element is called the same thing. Well, this title might just match the movie element, but this one here, another template, might match, in our imaginary world, a title element that's a child of an actor element, that's a child of an actor's element, that's an actor, that's a child of a database element, that's a child of the root. Which is to say, when you encounter a node in your tree that is a title element, and its parent is actor, and its parent is actors, and its parent is database, and its parent is the root of the document, how many templates are relevant to that such a node, given this layout? Well, definitely one, the bottom one, but doesn't the other one also, isn't the other one also applicable? It is, right? It matches a title node. It's just the latter, the blower one, is more specific, so let's turn to our formal definition of priorities. Well, a node test like this, a match value like this, is 0.0. What if you're more precise? Something like foo/bar, where you specify not only the node's name, but also its parent's name. Well, that has an implicit priority of 0.5, which is higher than 0.0, which means of these two, which one does in fact get applied? Right. When you have a conflict, not just with a built-in template, but with another template of your own, it again is the more precise one that gets called. So there are rules governing this. But if for whatever reason you didn't like that, well, you could say, you know what, the priority here is 100. I really want that one to be executed as well. So there is this priority attribute that you can specify that overrides these built-in or these default priorities. So just be aware. Yeah?
Would that top template necessarily match the title element, or only if it's a child of where you were before?
So my statement is made in the absence of any context. So yes, the top template will match a title element. How you get there, I am not making any claims about. So what you said is also true, that that template up top will only match a title element if you have previously applied templates to title elements. But that sort of goes without saying, right? This matches title elements. How during your recursive descent you get to those elements is sort of an irrelevant detail. It matches title elements. Right, how you get there is uninteresting. So far as I'm concerned in distinguishing these two, how you get there is uninteresting because at the point where you notice that the bottom one absolutely matches a title element that's a child of actor, child of actors, child of database, child of the root. But I'm arguing that the top one would also match such a node, just with a lower priority. However, this kind of match, database/movies/movie, now would we have contention when we encounter a title node in the document? Well, no. These are two distinct absolute paths There is no conflict now. Okay? Again, we're introducing more of the nitty-gritty. Take comfort in that if you're still acclimating to this, you can still, certainly for my blockbuster and B2B, focus more on the basics of last week. But that's priorities in a nutshell. You can also, incidentally, as your style sheets perhaps get more interesting or involved, whether for this project, maybe Xtube or beyond, you also have the notion of including or importing other files into a style sheet. You have two different mechanisms, XSL include and XSL import. The difference being when you include in file, it's like in C or C++, it's a sharp include. It's literally a copy paste of that file into this one, which means you have the same priority. The templates you might be including from the other file have this retained their original priorities. So if you have in one file a template that matches title and its priority is a 0.0, and you have one in the other file that also matches title, well, its priority might actually equal the priority of your other title element. So you need to be careful. If, however, you want to ensure that, you know, if you import someone else's style sheet, maybe your own, but if you import a style sheet with XSL import, all of those templates, by definition, will have lower priorities than the one that is importing, doing the importing. And that's useful because if, for instance, you grab off the shelf someone else's style sheet, you know, third-party software, a library in effect, you don't want their functionality, perhaps, to be clobbering yours if you happen to have namespace collision in effect. So using import ensures that you, the author of this style sheet, retain priority over any other templates that might also match. So just be aware of that. Let's take a look at some further examples. In fact, let's start with titles1.xsl. You have a printout of it. I think we can gloss over this because it, in effect, is a very, it's where we began tonight, in effect. But you have a printout of it. But you told me rather coincidentally to implement precisely this style sheet, I realize in retrospect. But title1, you have a printout of that. Title2, let's take a look at that because it takes a different approach to the very simple idea of printing movies' titles, and it does so with two different templates. So if in titles2.xsl, which should be alphabetically among your code printout for tonight, titles2.xsl, you'll notice that on line 6, we match on what type of node? The root. And it's that template, clearly, that jumpstarts our process, right? Because there's no other template that matches just the root. So there's no contention. All right, so here we go. The first line there declares a variable called movies. Well, turns out that XSLT does allow you to define variables, but they're not mutable. Once you set a variable's value, it stays that way, which means you can't, as you can in many languages, say in a for each loop, increment a variable. You can't update it on each iteration. Once you assign a variable a value, you cannot reassign it. So bear that in mind. The same is true with higher level functional programming languages. So what I do here with this variable is not for the purpose of, in line 7, updating it, but it's simply meant to be a shortcut so that so I can reuse it and really keep my code a little cleaner, if you will. So in line 7, I declare a variable called movies. The contents of that variable will, in effect, be what data type? A node set containing what kind of nodes? Movie nodes, and they will be in that node set, which, in effect, is a linked list, in what order? Random order? Document order. So they will be in document order. Okay, so now you reference variables like you do in Perl with the dollar sign. So bear that in mind. So on line 8, we now don't use apply templates, but we take more of a pull approach using our lingo from before, and we call template, rather than just sort of making this leap of faith as we do with apply templates, we call templates just like you would call a function or a method called print titles. And this is even closer in spirit to a method or function call, even more so than a template, than an apply templates is. So we are literally calling a template called print titles. You can pretty much guess what line 9 is doing. What are we doing with line 9? You're passing it a parameter called nodes, and the value of that parameter is going to be whatever the contents of the variable are. So in effect, we're passing a node set via a parameter called nodes. Well, hopefully, this template called printTitles has been designed to accept one such parameter. Well, let's take a look. Line 14 defines our template. Notice that when a defined template, a named template, as they're called, you give them a name. You don't give them a match attribute. So we're saying this is a template with the name of printTitles. What is going on with line 15? Just declaring a parameter. So this is like the signature of a method or a function. You're declaring the parameter. If we wanted to give it a default value, you could. You could say, for instance, select equals, and then you could give it some value. You could give it a string value if you were in a string context, or you could give it a node of some sort. Maybe by default, we want to give it sort of strange in this context, but you could hard code it to be movies, movie. We'll come back to this. You could hard code it by default. If you're not passed anything, just print the first movie title, where the predicate there, bracket one, is shorthand for printing the first element. But we'll come back to that. But suffice it to say, you can have default values. We don't for now. Well, what are we doing in line 16? What does that have the effect of doing, based on what I just said, actually? Printing the title of the first node. So this predicate here is actually shorthand for one of the functions we saw briefly last week, which is position. So when you have a context node, that is the node currently in question, well, what do we mean by that? Well, what we have here is we are saying when the position of a node equals 1, print out only its title. Because this predicate will only match how many of the nodes in the node set called nodes. Just one. And for whatever reason, the nodes are one indexed, not zero indexed. So tuck that away. So what that's doing is printing, as you said, the... let's see, what would it do? Let's associate this with the myblockbuster.xml. XSLT, no, that's okay. Yeah, so you'd get nothing because there is no node with a position of zero. So it sound, unless Stylus is being forgiving, it might not be a syntactical error, which it probably isn't because the values are probably not checked by the processor itself, or need not be. But one would work. In fact, let's fast forward for a moment, apply this thing. What this thing does, as you might guess, is print the titles of the movie. But the interesting question at hand is why? So let's take a look. And this is not to say this is the best way to do this. This is simply meant to highlight not only some additional syntax, like that position syntax, but you're about to see recursion and a way, in effect, of working around a functional programming language's limitation on not letting you mutate variables. You simply push another variable onto the stack, essentially, if you want to update a variable. So let's take a look. So line 16 is printing out the title of the first movie element. Then we print in line 17 a line break. What is line 18 asking? Yeah, in layman's terms, are there any more nodes to print? In other words, are the count of nodes greater than 1? Because if there are, that means you have a node at position 2, and maybe 3, and maybe 4, and so forth. And here, just for the sake of discussion, we make a recursive call. Not necessarily inefficient. It's a tail recursive call, so a smart processor should be able to optimize away any of the overhead that might in other languages be incurred. So here we have an explicit call template of print titles. We again pass in a parameter of nodes, but what value do we give it now? We're saying pass in the same node set, but only starting with node 2 and beyond. So in effect, we are truncating the start of this node list, this node set, and passing the remaining node list, sort of like Lisp with the cutter of the list, if you're a Lisp programmer, to the same template recursively. And at what point, where's our base case? When does this whole recursion stop? Well, exactly. Here's the base case, or here's the check, so that we bottom out. As soon as the node set is of size 1, this whole process stops. Yeah?
What happens if
Ah, what happens if you forget that check test? Well, let's go ahead and... Yeah, you saw my little smoke and mirrors routine there. If we actually just remove this thing altogether and just call template recursively, well, stylus, for one, will detect this. Stylus has not solved the halting problem. It is simply making an empirical guess that you are in an infinite loop with whatever techniques. I had to explicitly say yes before because stylus, for better or for worse, does not like to see recursion because it thinks, perhaps a little too prematurely, that you're caught in an infinite loop even when you might be smarter than stylus. So here is not an error. Now it's an error. A moment ago it wasn't an error. But if I say yes now and say, yes, stylus, trust me, well, now stylus gives you more of an error. The XSLT processor has exceeded the maximum recursion depth set under tools. There is probably an infinite loop in your style sheet. It could still be wrong, because clearly it maintains some kind of call stack and it keeps track of this, though why it's not just clobbering its own stack with a tail recursive call is silly implementation detail. But the short of it is that you get an infinite loop. Let's take a look. Yep, there it is. That's not proper HTML, but you get all the output. But then the thing never stops. Good question. So again, this is arguably a much less obvious implementation. But again, we've now highlighted how you use position, how you can induce recursion, how can you use parameterization, and arguably very reminiscent of most programming languages. Yeah.
Do names templates also have priorities?
Do what have priorities? Do name templates have priorities? I don't believe so in the spec because. I don't believe so, but let me check, because if you have two like-named name templates, I don't know if it's going to be a compilation error or a runtime error or if it's just going to choose one of them arbitrarily or the first it encounters. I'd have to check. That's a good question. I'll try to remember. I can easily look that up, so if I forget to address it at some point after tonight, just remind me, and I'll get back to you. Good question. All right, so how about some other uses of some of these ideas? Well, one of the things that you did in Project 1 when you finally deployed Xerxes was what? What was your challenge with Xerxes itself? Attribute conversion. So let me introduce just a few other building blocks, which in this context, none so interesting, but we'll put them into an interesting context in a moment. I promised earlier we'd address this data type known as a result tree fragment. You've seen how you can create a variable, and you saw how you can create a variable that's a node set. This, however, definition of a variable, does not create a variable called Oogle with a node set. Rather, this variable called Oogle has as its value what's in effect a string, literally that string. So though you might think that by defining a variable with XSL variable name and then inside of it as children, writing elements, what the value of this variable becomes is not a node set containing one element called foo, which in turn has children. Rather, it's effectively a string containing open bracket, FOO, close bracket, and so forth. Not what you might expect, and what XSLT2 will actually do is redress this so that you can actually declare node sets in this fashion and get back node sets, not RTFs, as they're called. There's an XSLT extension function that lets you convert an RTF to a node set, because an RTF in and of itself tends not to be a useful construct. But the short of it is that if you define either a variable like this or a parameter like this, where you specify its value not with a select statement, as we did previously, but as a child of that value, you don't get a node set. You might get a string, and that's fine. You might be happy with getting a string and just hard coding it there, or a number and hard coding it there. But if you want a node set, you can only use, for the most part, the select attribute, not a child-based definition. So in short, if you're unclear on the distinction, try not to define variables this way. And if you do, you'll realize that you might run into problems. but the problems might be more clear once you actually appreciate the reason that you might want to do this. The reason, in a nutshell, is that it might be useful to declare a variable in this way and not hard code some string here, but maybe call a template that, in effect, prints out nodes or returns nodes, in effect, that has some value to it. But that, too, would return an RTF. Yeah? Yes, there is a way to get back a node set, and that's actually a good segue to our discussion of copy, but it's not as straightforward as just this. What you can do is if you try, for instance, there are two different tags, which we'll see in a moment here, elements rather, copy and copy of. If you did a copy of, just know that what you get back is the same RTF. And we're not going to spend much time on copy because you'll see a few examples in a moment. If you print the value of an RTF, what you actually get here is what you see above there, the textual children. So just be aware of this, though it might be somewhat counterintuitive or annoying. But let's move to this copying nodes and not dwell on RTFs because that will soon be less of an issue with XSLT2. Two different tags, copy and copy of, the difference of which is essentially shallowness versus depth, how much each of these things do. What you have here in this bottom example is a template that matches either attributes or nodes and, in effect, creates a perfect copy of them recursively. Okay, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because I want to see these in context, but just let that imprint on your mind. That, in effect, creates a recursive copy of any attribute. Well, that's irrelevant because attributes don't have children, so it's sort of moot. But nodes very well might, because a node could be an element, it could be a document node, so forth, or rather, it would be an element. So, let's see. Okay, so this is why these slides are boring, because we'll see them in context in a moment. There also exist elements in XSLT that allow you to output, using XSLT syntax, actual elements and actual attributes, even comments, text nodes, processing instructions. So far, when we've seen this, we've actually seen, say, with our demonstrations, stuff like this. You might have an XSL template that matches on the root, and you might then, by default, output HTML. I'm going to cheat and not write valid XHTML here, but just say hi. So if I run this style sheet on any old, let's get this back in. So if I run this style sheet on my blockbuster.xml, I just get a web page saying hi. Well, I could, just to show you the use of these, and you'll see in examples why they're even more useful than this. This is just raw output. And because I don't have HTML prefixed with XSL, it's outputted as raw content. But I could similarly have said XSL element. I want an element called HTML, and then I'll close that element. I want the HTML element in turn to have an element called body. And inside the body, I want an XSL text node containing hi. So that would be the more verbose way of doing this. If you wanted an attribute of body, maybe BG color, you could say XSL attribute name equals BG color. And then the value of this attribute will be, what's that? Okay, green. Apply that. Now it works. Wow, smiles from green. So this is clearly more verbose than you would hope it would be. But as you begin to write more interesting style sheets, what you'll see is that this more proper syntax of explicitly defining an element and attribute actually becomes helpful or useful sometimes, if only because of its explicit nature. You can do this then with any of those types of nodes. You can also, incidentally, if you don't want to deal with saying XSL value of all the time, but you wanted to print in the context of your document the value of some variable or the value of some node, you can use what are called attribute value templates. So up top here, is out of context a variable called foo whose value is a string, quote unquote, bar. Below that, out of context, is just a fragment of HTML that I've written somewhere in my style sheet that I want outputted raw, but I don't want to say foo, I want to say what the value of foo is. So I could say XSL value of select equals quote unquote dollar sign foo. And even just to say that is rather verbose. Or you can use what are called attribute value templates, and you could just write in raw form what you want to say and use squiggly brackets, and inside those squigglies actually say what you effectively want to print the value of. So this HTML then, in theory, should print out. So this guy walked into a bar, right, and it's doing the substitution of the variable. So we'll see this too. Finally, in more interesting context than that hypothetical example, here we have three different things. We have a fragment of a style sheet up top plus an XML fragment below it to which it will be applied equals whatever the output would be. So this is sort of in one slide excerpts from what you might want to do in a style sheet. Notice at the top we have a variable called image directory, and it's selected to be a string that's quote unquote slash images. And it's just a useful way of reusing a path that I might have laced throughout an HTML outputting style sheet. I then might have a template in my style sheet called that matches photograph elements. And what I want to do for a photograph element is output an image in HTML. So I say open bracket img src equals quote unquote, and here's where it's useful to be able to use these attribute value templates. So you don't have to use the more verbose XSL attribute or XSL value of. You can simply say quote unquote image dir and then a raw slash and then in another pair of squigglies href. Now notice image dir has a dollar sign in front of it. Why? It's a variable. href does not. What's it implying? That's a path, and it's in fact one step whose implied access is child. So here again, we see some XPath. Now this makes sense when you consider what the XML layout is. Well, photograph element has a child called href that has some textual child, which is in this case headquarters.jpg. It's also got a width, or rather a size. So we specify up here, well, you know what? The width for this image is going to be the size child, which is this guy, followed by his width attribute. So it's a nice way in sort of one clean line to get at all of the data you want. So thankfully, XSLT is not always needlessly verbose. If you want, and again, I'm going quickly just to get out some of the basics before we conclude with some examples. If you want to, in effect, import not another style sheet, but another XML document, you can do that with this tag. You can use the document function and say somewhere in your document, XSL variable, give it a name, and then select, using the document function, the name of a document. So where I have an ellipsis here on the right, you can literally say foo.xml. And what that would put in a variable called dollar sign whatever, for the other ellipsis, it would put the root of the document. So you could have a variable called, let's just do it in here. You could have a variable called foo, and we could have it be referencing a file called foo.xml. So kind of wrapped, but not so such a big deal here. So what that puts in the variable called $foo is slash. But slash from foo.xml. It puts the root of the foo.xml document. So you'll see, too, how you can make use of something like that. If we, recursion we saw, extension functions, so we'll come back to this in a moment. Let's take a look at one of these examples then. We looked at our titles. I'm going to ask that you ignore the one called discounter 1 and discounter 2, because one of those files went to press before. Last time we used this demo, we made a lot of changes to it during lecture, which apparently I forgot to change back. So what you have is a non-working discounter 1. So ignore discounter 1 and discounter 2. The others are more interesting anyway. Let's take a look at type checker for a moment. Type checker.xsl, which is among your printouts alphabetically, is a style sheet that is meant to be more instructive than fun to play with. because all this thing does is print out counts of the number of different types of nodes in a document, and it prints out the contents of that document, just so that you can see some additional syntax, just to sort of tie some topics together from tonight. So notice we jumpstart the process in line 6 by matching the root, and then, not necessarily efficiently, just for demonstration purposes, I say the number of comment nodes in this document is count of //comment. So what do we have here? Well, what axis is implied by that XPath expression that's being passed as a value to the XPath's count function? What's //? Descendants or self. So it's effectively search the whole darn document for what? Nodes that pass the comment node test. So that in effect is going to return a node set of all the comment nodes, which in turn is going to be passed to the count function, which is going to give us a number from 0 to whatever. Okay, PI nodes, same thing. Text nodes, same thing. Element nodes, same thing. I just have to be slightly careful with the attribute nodes because I have to specify, I can't just say star here, right? Because star generally matches what? Elements. But in line 13, I want to match attributes. And so because the default, the implied axis is usually child and then star in the previous line, here we need to explicitly say attribute :: star. And here I can make a distinction. I've said a few times now that star matches nodes of the principal node type. When your axis is pretty much anything and you say star, you mean element nodes called anything. If, however, your axis is attribute, you mean not elements when you say star, you mean attribute names that are anything. And if you're on the namespace attribute, which we'll chat about next week, and you say star, you mean only namespace nodes. So in short, star almost always means the name of any element, but not if you're on the attribute or namespace axes. So the principal node type for every axis except 2 is elements. The principal node type for the attribute axis is attribute. And the principal node type for the namespace axis is namespace. So that's the careful distinction. Finally, what do I do in contents? Well, I output some raw text that says contents. And then I call a template explicitly called type checker. I pass it a parameter called nodes. And I select as the value of that parameter what? I think I heard it. I select everything. And if, well, is the simplest way of putting it. I select everything. And for the sake of time, let's forward to what the template is, type checker. It takes, of course, a parameter in line 23 called nodes. And then notice what we do. We simply iterate over the nodes that we've been given, and we do a sort of type checking, which is kind of interesting. Well, let's not look at this necessarily top to bottom. Let's look at some of the easier ones first. We've got a big old XSL choose here. Let's consider the second case in line 37. This second case, which you can spoil the answer with the comment, is essentially testing if the current node is what? A comment. Right? If you're following along with that, you're in good shape. It's a comment. Now, that's why we use the self axis, though, because we're considering a node iteratively. So whatever the current node is myself a comment node, yes or no? If yes, what do we do with it? We print it out, but we prefix that with comment :, so that I'll know in the output, you know, that was a comment. It wasn't something else. All right, what about line 47? This one, too, is pretty easy. If you can get this, you're in good shape. This, too, saying, am I a PI? If so, print out PI :, and then my name and my value. So notice I select the name using XPath's name function, which we haven't really seen used before because it's usually not necessary. And then we print out its value, which we have seen before. Text nodes. You tell me, since the comment doesn't say it all. What am I doing in line 53 if I'm a text node? Printing out just the first 32 characters, right, to save space. I'm using XPath's substring function just to print out the first 32 characters. And what am I doing with that XSL if? If it's longer than 32 characters, I print out an ellipsis to inform you that I've truncated this string. So just the cute little aesthetics. But again, just to show you how you might use if, how you might use another XPath function, string length, and greater than. And notice we don't have to escape greater than. The only one of these symbols that we do have to escape is less than, with the ampersand, LT, semicolon. Kind of ugly. All right, now let's bite off one of the more interesting ones. Let's go back up to the top. Attribute. How the heck does line 32 detect that I am an attribute? Because sadly, there is no attribute function that will tell you such. This is sort of extreme XPath coding. So think, let's do it in reverse order. What is this XPath function call telling us? This part should be easy. So I'm a current node in question. What am I counting? How many attributes my parent has. Okay. What is then this counting? Right. But the vertical bar, we've always said, is what operator? And I don't think anyone said it right.
Union.
Maybe someone did. If you didn't, you didn't say it loud enough. It's the union operator, which means if I union dot myself with dot dot slash at star, I'm saying union myself with my parent's attributes, which means if I am an attribute, am I increasing the size of this resulting set by unioning me with the larger set? No. So in this way, sort of a hack, but sadly, sort of a requisite hack right now. This tells you if you're an attribute node, because if by oring, unioning yourself with the true attributes of your parent, you don't change the size of the set, you are, in fact, an attribute. And not, for instance, a namespace node. There's also no namespace function, so we can't just quickly check that. But we can, if we look later, notice what we do here. What can I do in line 42? I similarly check how many namespace nodes does my parent have? Then I check how many namespace nodes does my parent have if I also union in myself. This time, if I'm an attribute, what's the size of dot union dot dot slash namespace star going to be? It's going to be one more than just the other count. And again, we spend little time on namespaces this week. Next week, we'll spend more time. But in short, I say this is extreme XPath coding because sometimes there are ways to achieve things, but not necessarily in the most straightforward fashion. So simply be aware of that. But checking if something's an attribute can, in fact, be useful. Namespace, perhaps less useful. XSL otherwise prints out the value of an element if we've exhausted all of the other possibilities. And our final demos, which will be fun to think on, well, should be useful to think on your own as well, in contrast with assignment with project one, you have three different versions of this program called Attribute Converter. What I would invite you to do, really as a mental exercise, is look over attributeconverter1.xsl, and what I think you'll find is that for the most part, it's fairly straightforward. It's rather long, but only because it uses the most obvious constructs to implement the notion of attribute conversion. And I think you'll see, based on the basics we've seen, that the most interesting lines, essentially, are between lines 36 and 49. What that essentially does, using syntax somewhat similar to our type checker, because we need to know, are we an element? Because only if we are an element do we have what, potentially? Attributes. So this is the juicy code, because in effect, what it's saying is, if I'm an element, go ahead in line 37 and print my name using this XSL element function, which I alluded to earlier. Then go ahead and do what in line 40? Iterate exactly over each attribute of the current element, which if it's zero, fine. This loop doesn't go any farther. But if there are attributes, what do we do with each of them using some of tonight's new syntax? We output what?
a new element using some attribute value templates, trickery, and some of the other new syntax, but notice that I've intentionally nested this inside of my previous element declaration so that this attribute that's now being outputted as an element is in effect a child of the original element. In attribute converter 2, you have another implementation of the same idea that takes more of the push approach. And we can revisit this next week as well, but it is useful to look over it on your own. It's maybe more advanced. Maybe this might be the intermediate implementation of the same idea, when you're comfortable with the idea of pushing content through a style sheet. In attribute converter 3.xsl was my attempt to make it as few lines as possible, which is not always necessarily the best thing. But this makes use of copy, which does a shallow copy, but then it uses apply templates to recursively dive down even deeper to copy child elements further. And we can come back to this, but what I would invite you to do is spend some time. You should certainly be comfortable with attribute converter 1, maybe attribute converter 2. And if you're really comfortable with attribute converter 3, project 2 should be a piece of cake. So we'll leave it at that for tonight. We'll have section in about 5 minutes in room 106 where we'll do more of a code walkthrough of project 2. Otherwise, I will see you next week.